in the library.
And available, I think, from Paul Brierley in Columbus, Ohio, where he plays tuba in the Ohio Symphony, Columbus Orchestra, while he also is an aircraft engineer or something like that. This repertory is there. You can see what he played. I don't need to go into great detail about it, but you should go into that kind of detail about it. You go back and read Goldman's book on the band's music. Almost everything we need to know up to that particular point, the completion of that book, is in Goldman's really superb book. And the book that other book that has now come out recently by Richard about 8 years ago, the publisher asked me to write, and I told him I appreciated the honor, but I was not the man to write it, that Dick Goldman was the man to write it, and I went to New York and had to talk Dick into writing the book. But I'm glad he did, because it's another really first-class book. It's the concert band, the band's music, and then this last one, the name of which loses the most. But all of these books deal in repertory. They deal in the past, they deal in the present, and they ruminate about the future. It's worth reading Richard Goldman's first book alone just to read Percy Grainger's preface to it. The best single history of the wind band that I know anywhere. And its music is right there in Percy Grainger's introduction to the band's music by Richard Goldman. So the material that Sousa provided for us is the standard Wagner overtures, the standard Wagner repertory, operatic repertory, the standard light operatic repertory from France, his own material, the music of Victor Herbert, and of course that marvelous collection of little pieces that people just seem to love. Marvelous novelties, two bullfrogs on a log. The xylophone was such a fantastic attraction to people. I have at home an Edison cylinder disc. Yes. Well, that's Whitwell's company. Everything that's there. You can get the National Fascist Band of Italy, the 10-inch record in Lynchburg. Jack Daniels, a good man. Yes, sir. I'll remember that one. I picked up an Edison cylinder playing machine 2 years ago at an auction up in a little once big fat lumber town in Michigan called Copemish, came across in the back of a farmer's truck, and I dickered for it and had it restored. And one of the first cylinder discs that I stumbled onto was featured the xylophone and the banjo and all the clog dancers and all the bone rattlers, because those are things you could stick right up into one of those microphones and make all the sound you wanted. And that was, again, that kind of literature. It was a novelty, a public entertainment medium. And it was at this absolutely superb. Sousa could sell out his places anywhere he went playing this literature and playing it obviously wonderfully well. What he bequeathed us in the way of concert literature didn't seem to be very different from what he had inherited from Patrick Gilmore, however. His influence is, I think, that of his personal influence on Austin Harding, who was very happy in his company, and whom Sousa admired very much, and for whom a great deal of many good things happened, and at whose hand was erected the entire Illinois band structure upon which everything any of us are doing is based. But this was a literature that consisted mainly of Italian operatic excerpts from the overture down through the ballet music, and the novelty pieces that brought us into the 20th century. And into the 20th century, the American band went along in its very same role with no change. The first serious change came in Britain. And this is, nobody knows how this all sort of happened, but it did. The British band, as we know, an instrumentation designed for mobility. Literally, when you see the Brigades of Guards band parade at the changing of the guard, that's a double 28-piece band. Whenever you see a Brigades of Guards band play in Kensington Park, Hyde Park, in front of St. Paul's Cathedral, or at any horse show, garden party, or tennis match, that's half of these groups, because they can only afford to hire half of the groups at a time. And these groups are always, when they're off of the post, so to speak, somebody pays. And the full complement of the band is, of course, both supported by the regiment and by the government. And since the regiment was involved in this from the beginning, there was established a journal of music for all of the bands of the British Army. And this is the basis for our contemporary wind band repertoire. They have been called, according to the two companies that put them out, that still survive, the Chapel Army Journal and the Boothby and Hawks Military Band Journal. And the Boothby and Hawks Journal absorbs the old Bosworth Journal and the old edition Lafleur, which was another old edition, which was not French but British, and absorbed into that catalog. Hawks and Son, of course, were absorbed into the marriage of Boothby and Hawks. And on that basis, there did exist a considerable transcribed repertory with the handful of original pieces by Holst, Vaughan Williams, Gordon Jacob, that was available to a British band, let us say, at the time of the Great British Empire Exhibition, 1924. And you can still see on the front covers of some editions, someplace in some schools, that beautiful black paper with a gold embossing and great fancy printing that's called Empire, British Empire Edition of the Boothby and Hawks catalog. And for this British Empire Edition, bless their hearts, was commissioned William Byrd Suite and came out, took out a material, right, two pieces alone worth it all. And in addition to this, of course, there did exist for all British bands everywhere in the world that subscribed to this journal every conceivable kind of literature that you would want. Universe class edition, playable by from 28 to 56 men. Yes?
Could you very quickly run down the 28-man roster?
If I can recall, it's the instrumentation of the original E-flat suite of Holst, which is flute interchangeable piccolo, E-flat clarinet, or two E-flat clarinets, solo and first, second and third clarinets, alto saxophone, tenor saxophone, four E-flat horns, three cornets, two trumpets, three trombones, baritone, tuba, percussion. No bari sax, no tenor sax, no alto clarinet, no bass clarinet. Did I say bassoon? One bassoon. One bassoon, minimum, usually two. I knew there was something I'd left out.
No.
Yeah, wait, excuse me, oboe. Oboe, yes, definitely. One, minimum, two, flush. But the family's, as you can see, very, very, very complete. And it's interesting to play the E-flat Suite of Hosts with those 28 players. Works. And an interesting sound. That was what all this instrumentation is for. The Chapel Army Journal is exactly the same instrumentation.
Album.
Oh, it's the same record, Harry.
Oh, wow.
We just got you twice. It's the same record. Yeah, it's a repressing.
Wow.
They call that packaging, Harry. No, it's the same pressing. The first pressing had on it only Holst and Vaughan Williams. The first repressing added the Granger Hill song. And that's the one with the drawings on the cover. The first cover had the household cavalry with the red coats, the winter coats. And the third one, which has just come out, has some instruments of assorted nature on the cover. And that's also the same one. So don't go buy that one, Harry. Unless you're really so inclined. But I understand the surface is really terrific. So this repertory that they presented to us was what we really began with in our country. And Mr. Harding was the one that began it.
Pardon me again, but how much, Dr. Sinnell, of that Chapel Army Journal and the Hoosier and Hawks Military Journal, how much of that music would you, is a quite a bit of it still available?
Quite a bit of it is still available in the Boosie edition, not so much in Chapel. Chapel is no longer owned by Chapel, and it's part of a big complex of things. And they're starting to get out of the business. It's sad, but they are. If you want to get copies of the Parsifal Good Friday music, Pineapple Paul, La Boutique Fantasque, just to name three of the interesting ones, or the four-way suite of Coates, or the London suite of Coates, or any of these pieces that were so outstanding in that journal, I urge you to get on it right now, get on it fast, because they're going to disappear before anybody knows. A lot of the Boosie Hawks are going to disappear too, just with normal attrition. This provided a repertory that brought us into the period when Dr. Harding really was making the University of Illinois Concert Band the great groundbreaking group that it was. He played mixtures of his own transcriptions and the best from these two catalogs. As the American School Band Movement began, from that first contest, which was held in 1924, it needed a lot of music. And this was a great bonanza for the British band catalogs. We had one very serious publishing house in the country at that time, in the band field. That's the company that had gotten the government contract for the First World War. That was the Carl Fisher Company. And you will notice it says up in the corner, the Carl Fisher Military Band Journal. And they had the contract for the First World War, when we suddenly found that we were in a shooting war with a regimental setup that was German and French, and which called for a band for every so many men, and we had no bands and no music and no instruments. And so everything that made music education got started right there. I am going to write a book someday called Mars and the Muse, because they do go together in remarkable ways. And so on this basis, American publishers began to issue. And there occurred then the need for a variety of pieces, for required works on contests. And politics again reared its beautiful head. And lots of pieces were commissioned, transcriptions were commissioned, I should say. And even some original pieces were likewise commissioned, such as an overture by Henry Hadley called Youth Triumphant. I remember when this one was played 42 times on a certain Saturday in Cleveland, when I learned it. And there were a lot of pieces of this kind that came out as functional fodder, you might say, for the contests, some of which are still around. And there occurred at this same time the bringing over to our country of all whatever there was from anywhere else. Being enterprising and aware of what was going on, Harding played the Mieszkowski's 19th Symphony for band, which is a quite fantastic piece. If you want to know where Aram Khachaturian came from, that's it. It's all there. He was Khachaturian's teacher. Khachaturian just helped himself with both hands, wrote ballets instead of dull symphonies. And there was nothing that didn't seem to begin to boil up into this cauldron of the school band contests. And this was the place in which a great many men in this room can remember their first musical experiences. I know I myself can remember very vividly all of that period. I was in the contest from 1928 on. And they were vivid learning experiences. And here began to break out a great many American publishing houses. From them comes the current repertory. There are so many houses that exist today that barely existed prior to this, or whose existence was that of piano music, or music for the theater or for films, but had no contact with what you would call the school market. And this vast school market is the one which has made the American publisher. And it is for this field that such a great percentage of the pieces that we play were written. It's somewhat remarkable and unusual that a man like Percy Grainger can quietly go on all by himself, whether anybody listened or cared or not, just writing what he thought should be written. I'm glad he did. But he was a rather exceptional person. It's one of those crazy things. It seems like the more you want to do for somebody, the less they care. If Grainger was a complete band man, the ideal band man, the world of the band in the United States might have just taken him completely to their heart, which they did not. When he came to this country, he was one of the world's great pianists, one of the world's most famous pianists, one of the greatest personalities of his time. He chose to come here because he didn't like the idea of getting into the British Army. He was an Aussie, and Aussies don't like to be in British armies, I'm told. They want to be in their own armies. And so he came to this country, settled here. And first thing you knew, we were in it. And the first thing he did was go down and enlist in it. He enlisted, he wanted to be a bandman, bandsman. And he did. And he picked up a saxophone and learned to play some little ditty on it. And when the examiner found out that the little ditty was all he could play, that it was all he could play on the saxophone, he said, well, I can play anything you would like on the piano. And then they discovered who he was. And consequently, he became the toast of Fort Hamilton and later of Fort Monmouth. And he literally became a complete army man. And he was always fascinated by all of the reed instruments. Not by the brasses, but by the reeds. Can't you just see him driving everybody crazy on that force, practicing on every reed instrument he can lay his hands to? Here's this really wailing pianist trying to learn to play the saxophone. And he worked at every one of them. I mean, he really worked at it. And he started scoring things right there. All these things he'd been hearing that he didn't know quite where to go. Boy, he was pouring them all into the band like crazy. And everybody was just saying, there he is, you know. There's that idiot, you know. And I'm afraid it's a condition that persisted. And even after the war, he went to West Point and went up there and took all of his music. And that's the only place that really befriended him, I must say. They played everything that he had, and he'd go up there and try stuff out and bring it back home and rewrite it and take it back again. And Resta would wail through it and bring it back and play it again. Yeah, but it was just Resta and Granger, and that was all. And then I got into the act with him. But it's remarkable that a man like that could be all by himself, completely ignored by everybody, all of the big contest movement, the big university band movement. Strange. Well, anyhow, the materials that began to pile up for the band now make what we call our basic repertory. That repertory is a combination of all kinds of things, like the old Glenn Miller medley. Something old, something new, an awful lot that's borrowed, and much that shouldn't be blue. So you have to sort out what this is. And a lot of that sorting has now been done for us over the last 25 years by the exemplary conductors of this country's remarkable university bands, of which we have a very, very great many, as you know, and many responsible men, many of them, who by their sense of leadership and by their enthusiasm and their dedication to a fresh original literature for the wind band have made it possible. Who's all the people who have been knocking on everybody's doors for years, the service bands of the country that have done the same. And these pieces would, I should think, have to be divided into categories of original material and transcribed material. They certainly have to include the exemplary pieces by Vincent Persichetti, would certainly have to include the exemplary pieces by Václav Nelibel. Isn't it remarkable that only in this country is it possible for a man one year to be completely unknown and next year to have 14 tunes on the market. It would have to include, without any question, the remarkable things that were written by Morton Gould at a long period of time when he was concentrating very much on this. He hasn't been doing as much recently, but it would have to include his pieces. And here again, for every one of us who has played 4,000 rousing performances of American Salute, you owe it to him to go out and buy the ballad. You owe it to him to go out and buy Prisms and play it, and ballad and replay it, and the symphony. You would certainly have to include the pieces of Norman Delajoie. You would have to include the pieces of Holst and Vaughan Williams. And to the additional aspect of this sort of thing, I should think you could not pass over some really very outstanding pieces for young bands that have been written by Claire Grund. Some of the pieces for young bands that have been written by Frank Erickson, as well as those that have been written for mature groups of any kind. You would have to include those unique pieces being contributed by a very fresh and very vital musical mind, Warren Benson. Man whose concept of the wind group is marvelously different, wonderfully approachable. Because Warren is different. Quite remarkable man. It would have to include the one piece that Aaron Copland has out and out written on a commission from you. The piece gets better every day. The outdoor overture he redid himself. And there are other little aspects of his work that have been released from time to time, but as a breadth of work, Emblems is an all-encompassing piece. It would have to include Music for the Wind Band by Robert Russell Bennett, which includes more than one score, and which he told me at a very pleasant dinner last June in New York will soon include a new piece which will be simply called Preludes. And the Preludes carry the names George, Cole, Irving, and the last. Jerome. Those are the four times. George, Cole, Irving, and Jerome. He'll be 80. He was 80. He is 80. This month. It'd be nice to salute him on a program this next year. Of course, we'd have to include all of the wind band works of Percy Grainger. And that's a lot of them. Not just Lincolnshire Posey, but all of them that he did in such a remarkable way. I would think that with the increase in interest that Dr. Hansen has shown in the medium, he now writes, and by the way, is a very vital man because he isn't answering the phone for 40 hours a day at the Eastman School anymore. It doesn't mean he isn't busy. I think that the works he's come to in his late life are, along with Chorale and Hallelujah, parts of this repertory. I only wish he had started sooner. I kept saying to him, I told you so. Then I was a fresh young kid from Cleveland. It would, of course, have to include the pieces by Gordon Jacob. It would have to include the pieces by Carol Fusa. And then there are so many remarkable one-shot guys with their marvelous one-two, like Peter Menner, who will not write another. He refuses to write another. But it has to be there. He says he won't do it because it's all those damn transpositions. And I told him, now that's really not much of an excuse for being a lazy lout. I told him, you write it anyway. Write it in C, which it ought to be in anyhow. And somebody can take care of the transposition, but just write us another piece. No, not liable to do it. Even though he really wung it all away. He wrote it, got a commission for it, got it published. I recorded it. He gets it all the ways. Won't do anything more. Yes. Peter Menin. Menin. Yes. Although there does exist works for winds other than this one. Certainly the B-flat symphony of Paul Hindemith has to be a basic piece. In styles, I think without any question, it certainly has to include Latham's choral preludes, which are remarkable of their kind, I think. Suite Française, along with West Point and the two marches, are pieces of neo. Certainly the Suite Française must be there. Opus 99 of Prokofiev, the one-shot piece, really has to be there. Owen Reed's Mexican Folk Song Symphony, La Fiesta Mexicana, really has to be there. Arnold Schoenberg's Theme and Variations has to be there. Gunther Schuller's Meditation has to be there. Leslie Bassett's Designs, Images, and Textures, and of course Schuller's Textures also. The list sort of goes on and on. Florent Schmidt, Dionysiac, would be, I should think, one that could not be left off of anybody's list. Dionysiaques. Dionysia. Published by Duran. I also think it should include F.W. Meacham's American Patrol. I think it's a great fit. And of all the patrols that have been written, that's the best one. Piece I'd play anytime for anybody, anywhere. It certainly would include, again, I'm sorry that we had only the one piece from him, but it would have to include Ingolf Dahl's remarkable sinfonietta, one of the sad tragedies of my life and of yours is the death of John Barnes Chance. And everything that he wrote should be there. So many things that could also come on here. You all have your contributions to make in addition to these I have mentioned here. This is not a list or a private list of favorite works or anything of the kind. That's just the way they all happen to fall out. Most of the material which I recorded, I would consider to be in that category. There are so many marvelous little pieces that you can't get to them all mentioning them, but it'd all certainly be there. We don't have enough pieces like the Autumn Walk of Julian Work. I know that. We don't have enough pieces that explore the quiet timbres like that does. We'd certainly have to include on anything list like this the Fanfare and Allegro of James Clifton Williams, symphonic suite. Two of his other quiet pieces, Igor Stravinsky, Circus Polka, would have to be there. Richard Wagner, Trauer Symphony. The Mendelssohn Overture. William Schumann, George Washington Bridge, Chester. These would be essentials. It does not include pieces. I'm not including the Stravinsky symphonies in this area. Classifying that in the wind ensemble category of pieces for from 8 to 24 instruments. But this is a kind of basic rundown. Let's exchange information now. Who has more to add? Yes, Jeannie. Third Symphony. I thought I mentioned Walter Hartley. I meant to if I didn't.
Why not mention Ives?
Charles Ives, well, they're late works, late coming works. I think they should be mentioned. The Country Band March, great march. That's a setting again, but the March Intercollegiate, big tune. But after that, Mountains and Steeples and other things are in the next category.
I have a question. Mm-hmm.
That's why I say I'm not classifying it in this category. That would be, I think, in another wind category, along with the talk, the spiel, and I mean, a billion pieces. Yeah, million pieces from 24 down. More and more coming along every day. It's getting to be, the list is piling up very, very fast.
Rockford?
Yeah, I should think George Rockford piece should be in there. Yeah. Well, those are transcriptions by John Cramp, and I put them in another place. Yeah. Hovhaness, definitely. Hovhaness, definitely. Yes, I should think Roger Nixon should also be there. Particularly do I think for a remark. I think for me, I think Roger Nixon's best piece is not necessarily the big swinger, but I think Reflections is a remarkably good piece. We don't have many pieces like Reflections, which explores again the quiet timbres of the group. We're not quite grown up enough yet where everything has to be a blockbuster. And our programs are a little hard to put together from that regard. I'm putting together a program of marches for a concert that I'm doing with what they're calling the Fennell Symphonic Wind at the Wolf Trap Farm Park for the Performing Arts, the first such farm performing arts park we have in our country near Washington in Vienna, Virginia. At the end of July, the last day of July, I'm doing a concert called Marching Along, all marches. The players are professional players in Washington. And it is all marches, running all the way from the national emblem on the Mall through music for fifes and drums, music for bugles and drums, about 12 minutes out of the music from the Civil War album, ending with a storm gallop. And that's the end of one third of the program. Second third of the program is, and it's all these segments of the program are named after record titles. And the third one, the middle part of the program is called Hands Across the Sea. And that has but many of the great ones on it. Inglesina, Old Comrades, Father of Victory, March Opus 99. What else we got on there? Valdres. The next part of the program is called Circus Screamers, and that has Barnum and Bailey in Storm and Sunshine. The next part of the program is called Broadway Marches, and that has Strike Up the Band, Get Me to the Church on Time, and the March of the Siamese Children. Yeah. No, publishers won't touch them. And then the last part of the program is Crown Imperial. Program's played in thirds, so that there is time for rest in between, but it's all designed around that thing. And I've not done such a program as that outside of the Eastman School of Music. I'm going to see whether I sell two tickets or three. Everybody always says, oh man, boy, I love those marches. They're just great. I like to hear those marches. I bet you nobody comes. But I've at least put out the nibble for them to come. I hope they'll come anyhow. Because if they don't come, I don't come back, as they say. Next, the area of transcription. Among many, many remarkable transcriptions, and your papers that you generously filled out, and believe me, which told me a very great deal, which information I cherish, and as I told you, will be kept strictly confidential. These statistics will go to nobody. And if I ever do need to use any of these statistics, I will have to have your individual permission for them, and I will so seek it. These transcriptions on my book are heavily loaded in the British band journals. And they are only the published transcriptions, and not necessarily the ones available individually from somebody like Mr. Hansley. Mr. Hansley will give you anything out of his library for your interest and a few pennies. And marvelously generous man. I'm talking now of the standard things that anybody could buy anywhere and that anybody might know of. And it would have to certainly include the Come Sweet Death of Bach in the Leiden transcription, being aware as I am that there are others. Bach, Luther, Cum Susitot. We'd have to include the transcription of Mars from the